Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Friday, February 4th, 2022. Present in the room today are Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Representative Josephson. On Teams, we have Representative LeBon. I believe online we have Representative Rasmussen, myself, Co-Chair Merrick. And we'd like to wish Jody, one of our finance staff, a very happy birthday today. So thank you for all that you do for us. And wish everybody a happy, positive Friday. And at today's meeting, we have Neil Steiniger, Director of Office of Management and Budget, presenting the governor's supplemental requests. Welcome, Director Steiniger. Please come to the table, introduce yourself for the record, and we will listen to your presentation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Neil Steiniger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. You should have two separate spreadsheets, one a single-page summary, another a pretty hefty packet here. First, I'll draw your attention to the single-page summary. This summary here is breaking down the governor's supplemental requests into three main categories. Supplementals submitted on December 15th that were included in the regular operating or capital budgets. Supplementals submitted on December 15th as part of our fast-track supplemental bill, as well as supplementals that were submitted on February 1st as part of HB 300. And those are the normal supplemental process that's due on the 15th day of legislative session each year. In total, they add up to $954.9 million in unrestricted general funds. This includes $795.6 million as part of the 50-50 dividend plan, splitting the earnings reserve POMV draw into a 50-50 dividend, have to be used for FY22 operating budget expenditures and have to be used for a dividend payment proposed in our fast track supplemental bill. If there are no questions on the overall summary, I can move to the other spreadsheet that goes into each supplemental item in detail. Just as way of kind of framing this, the spreadsheet in front of you is organized in a fairly technical manner based on what bill and where in the bill each supplemental item is located. So there are a couple of things that, because of just where they're located in the appropriation bills introduced to the legislature, like items may be separated by a couple of pages. So I'll try and highlight that as I go through them. Additionally, there are some capital supplemental appropriations that we discussed in the capital budget meeting hearing the other day. So I may, move through those fairly quickly.
Representative Josephson.
Chair, Mr. Steiniger, when you say on the smaller chart, you have the first box and you say those are supplementals attached to the regular operating budget. How do they have an effective date of May 15th? And the reason I ask is, what distinguishes them from any other operating budget item?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson, thank you for the question, because that is some important sort of framing of these supplemental requests. The items included in the regular operating or capital budget that were supplementally effective, as you note, have an effective date prior to July 1st of 2022, so effective in fiscal year 22. Those items were included in those bills because, as we looked primarily on the capital budget side, as we looked to finance a capital budget plan for the state, we chose to utilize surpluses in fiscal year 22. So they're more of a they're distinguished from other supplementals by being more of a spending policy decision, whereas other supplementals tend to be, the traditional idea of a supplemental tends to be a place where a state agency may have, encountered an unforeseen event that results in a shortfall in their budget requiring a supplemental. So there is kind of a distinguishment here between those two different types of supplementals. Policy decisions where we are, looking to start a new activity or finance a capital project in advance of July 1st, whether it is to kind of get a leg up on the operational need of that project, or if it's to, you know, simply find a financing mechanism that helps cover those costs. And then things that are true, you know, shortfalls that are really, you know, unanticipated and unavoidable costs to the state government.
Thank you.
So moving to the larger spreadsheet, the first three items here are fast track supplemental items that are part of the operating numbers section of the fast track supplemental bill. Just for those watching, there's different sections of appropriation bills, numbers section and language section, and this document's sorted in that order. So here, the first item, we have the permanent fund dividend hold harmless program. This is connected to the 50-50 dividend proposal. Paying a second dividend payment in fiscal year 22 will require funding for the hold harmless program, which ensures that folks aren't kicked off of public assistance rolls as a result of receiving a dividend. Item three is to address trial backlogs in the judiciary and the court system. And this is to kickstart a reopening of jury trials. There's costs necessary there as a result of trying to keep jurors, you know, safely distanced during trials, and there's costs for security and spacing for those needs. The next item, row number four, is $2 million for legislative per diem to pay for per diem for legislators. The next section is capital numbers section in the fast track supplemental bill. Most of these items we covered the other day, so unless there's a specific item the committee has questions on, I'd request permission to move forward through those.
Yes, thank you. And let the record reflect, we were joined by Representative Wohl at 1:42 p.m., please.
So that moves us forward to page six, which is where the mental health operating items begin from the regular supplemental bill. This is HB 300. These items are all in the Department of Corrections here, and you'll see they have negative dollar values. What is happening here is the Department of Corrections is experiencing shortfalls, a combination of resulting in a combination of issues related to both staffing needs and the need for overtime, as well as the large number of inmates that are housed within Department of Corrections awaiting trial. That rate of pre-trial to sentenced inmates is much higher now because of that case backlog, and that's creating supplemental needs in the Department of Corrections. However, as a result of just operational changes due to COVID and the way that costs in medical care in the correctional institutions, you know, has been impacted by COVID in a way that's actually saved money, they're able to transfer some money from the medical side of the correctional institution management to the population side. So what you see here are the negative side of that transfer. So the moving of the money out of the medical side. Later we'll see the moving of the money into the institution director's office.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You mentioned the ratio of pre-trial to post-trial. Is that greater than one? Is the majority of people in corrections right now pre-trial?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I believe so, but I also believe that we might have Director Wilkerson with Department of Corrections who could give the actual ratio for you.
Ms. Wilkerson?
Thank you. For the record, this is April Wilkerson, the Director of Administrative Services. Through the chair to Representative Wohl, you are correct. Our current ratio of unsentenced population that is incarcerated versus the sentencing population is greater. So we're currently running about a 54-56% of our population in custody is currently unsentenced.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Is this unusual either for the state of Alaska or for other states nationally to have a greater than 50% pre-trial prison population?
Through the chair to Representative Wohl, we would need to do some statistics. Alaska is one of seven unified states that operates both jails and prisons, and I am not quite sure what the current ratio is for those other six states. But we can look at that and get that back to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So moving to page seven, we're moving into the operating numbers section of the regular supplemental bill, so non-mental health-related items. So the first item is in the Division of Personnel and the Department of Administration, and this is a contract to maintain a online training platform that does both training resources for state employees as well as your online evaluation system. And this is startup costs for that program that the department is looking to implement before the start of the next fiscal year so that we can start transitioning people over to this new training management system. Item 39, or line 39, is also in the Department of Administration. This is a federal surplus property program. There's availability of revenues, federal revenues from selling of federal surplus property that they're going to be able to use to do some building expansion. On line 40 in the Office of Public Advocacy, there's $250,000. This is related to Medicaid funding on behalf of those clients of the Office of Public Advocacy in the work that they do to help them for Medicaid services. This is a match to funding, federal funding that's in the Medicaid program that gets paid for out of the Office of Public Advocacy. Row 41 is $750,000 to support increase in positions and costs in the Office of Public Advocacy related to that trial backlog that's driving those costs in both the court system and Department of Corrections. Row 42 is a grant that comes from the Municipality of Anchorage to the Office of Public Advocacy in the amount of $105,000 that was received this year. So item 43 is the first of several salary adjustments for a correctional officer's cost of living adjustment salary agreement with the ACOA, Correctional Officers Association.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, the salary adjustments total $10,400, or is that in thousands?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, $10,400 within the Correctional Academy. And there will be several of these that add up to, I believe the total is in the $2.5 million range, once you include all the correctional officers in the institutions themselves, it's much larger. Item 44, as I mentioned earlier, there are supplemental needs within the Department of Corrections related to both the need for additional overtime and staffing issues they're experiencing and that rate of individuals that are pre-trial, which generate costs. So the next handful of items actually are really related to that and are the opposite side of those transfer outs that we talked about earlier. So items 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, and 50 all are part of that same issue. Items 51 through 64 are the other pieces of that correctional officer salary study that you see, in the different institutions themselves. 65, again, is more specifically related to the pretrial issue, $4 million in pretrial services. That's a bulk of the supplemental needs within the Department of Corrections.
Representative Ortiz.
Actually, let him finish down to 67 and then
Steiniger.
Mm-hmm. So 66 is supplemental needs in the CRCs, or community residential centers. This is $2.7 million, roughly. And on row 67, they are looking, this is electronic monitoring, so this is for electronic monitoring of those, you know, not housed in institutions, and there's supplemental need of $300,000.
Mr. Steiniger, so if we do an attempt to total up under the category of corrections, if we were to pass the supplemental as being proposed here, what would be the total added revenue that would be going to corrections with the supplemental?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, so we're netting about $4 million in the reductions from the healthcare side. Without netting those reductions, you're looking at an increase of roughly $16 million, but then that $4 million nets out from that and brings it down to roughly $12 million supplemental need.
And follow up. And can you give us a quick review again as to the reasons why we're seeing this transfer of monies for medical? It sounded like COVID, but I don't understand how. Anyway, could you explain, summarize that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'd actually like to ask if Ms. Wilkerson might be able to give a lot more nuance on that. I can give a very high level, but it may not be as satisfactory as she can give.
Ms. Wilkerson?
And thank you. For the record, this is April Wilkerson, Director of Admin Services again. Basically, what we have had is we've had some related to COVID. A lot of our institutions have experienced COVID outbreaks, and we've locked down our institutions. And that has resulted in suspended contracts. From the providers are not entering into the facilities to provide that programming support. We have moved some of the contracts over to our institutional support staff, our ed coordinators, and they've been providing continued program, but at a much greater lower number and volume. So there's a lot of one-on-one efforts, which those efforts together have resulted in a lapse for the FY22 budget.
Representative Ortiz.
Thanks for that explanation. As we move forward in this particular area, and assuming that the COVID situation gets better for everybody, including the folks in corrections, do those savings then in the future go away?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, we anticipate as the COVID response and efforts are addressed, we do not anticipate these funds being available in the future. We also don't anticipate some of the higher costs that are occurring in the institutions to continue either. So we have a lot of overtime resulted from staff that are out due to COVID-related issues. We're experiencing increased contracts. For example, we've utilized contractors to come in and cover for inmate workers that are unable to provide that service, like for kitchen services and food prep. We're utilizing contractors at a much greater cost, which is the result in the showing in the result of the supplemental need in the institutions. So we don't anticipate the savings from the health and rehabilitation programs, but we also anticipate reduced costs in the institutions as we move forward and back to more normal operations.
Question?
Yes, Representative Ortiz.
And from Mr. Steiniger. So, Mr. Steiniger, depending on how you look at it, whether it's $12 million in addition or $16 million in addition, generally the supplementals imply, okay, we pass a budget and then we have unexpected expenses that were not covered in the first appropriating budget, and so then we have to meet those issues with the supplemental. Is that what we're talking about here, or are we talking about trying to jumpstart initiatives that are perhaps a part of a future budget, but we're trying to get a little head start on that? You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, what we're looking at here in corrections was kind of the exception of the cost of living agreement entered into with the bargaining unit. We're looking at, you know, unanticipated cost pressures within the department. And I'd like to note this transfer from the health side to the institution side is a one-time thing just for fiscal year 22. So it's not a proposal to kind of adjust those base budgets going forward, because as you heard Director Wilkinson note, you know, those savings and those costs, they don't expect to sustain over time. This is to manage that FY22 cost. But they are really, you know, costs being incurred in the Department of Corrections that need to be addressed, that are, you know, unanticipated needs, you know, as a result in a lot of these cases of COVID. The cost of living adjustment was, you know, a bargain, you know, bargain term with the union. So that's, you know, a new cost and not necessarily, you know, some emergent event, but really a cost to address, you know, pay issues in the union.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, the mention of overtime came up during COVID. Is that supplemental? I see there's a COLA adjustment. Is there needed payroll to add for the overtime, or is that already in the budget? And part two is, are the institutions still on lockdown? And do they anticipate having these programs restored as soon as lockdown is removed, and when would that be?
Through the chair, Representative, I'll address the first half of your question. I think might defer the second half to Director Wilkerson. The cost of overtime is part of this supplemental increase. So it's accommodated within their budget, but it's creating these cost pressures that need to be, you know, need to be accounted for through the supplemental. So it is a factor in that. The cost of living adjustment, you know, part of this, you know, part of the desire here in giving a pay raise to correctional officers is maybe to, you know, be able to recruit better and hopefully not have the need for as much overtime and as much, you know, burnout, and, you know, solving some of those recruitment issues will help that. But I'll defer the second part of your question to Ms. Wilkerson.
Ms. Wilkerson?
Thank you. For the record, again, this is April Wilkerson. Through the chair to Representative Wool, I would like to take the opportunity to change my terminology. The facilities are not in lockdown status anymore. What the terminology that we use is outbreak status, which it's not that we're locked down, we're just following a different criteria for individuals that are coming into the institutions. So I would like to use the term outbreak status. As of right now, we have, I believe, 8 institutions that are in outbreak status due to the number of COVID cases, active COVID cases that are in those institutions. We are continuing to provide programming with our staff. And as the institutions come out of outbreak status, we're doing more group type of programming. But as the COVID cases drop in the communities, we do anticipate getting these suspended contracts back in place. I just don't have a date on that at this time.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for that explanation about outbreak and that some institutions are under that status and some aren't. Are visitors allowed in institutions, whether in outbreak or not in outbreak mode? And the ones that are not in outbreak mode, can I assume they're fully open to visitors from family and attorneys, et cetera?
Through the chair to Representative Wool, we do allow visitors, and we definitely are allowing attorneys both in person, as well as we, through the initial periods of COVID, we set up teams and computer access, and so they have both options to visit with their clients that are incarcerated.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. And family, is that, I appreciate the answer about the attorneys, but if an institution is in outbreak mode, are visitors allowed, family or otherwise? And also in non-outbreak mode, I'm assuming it's, if it's non-outbreak mode, visitors are allowed, and then programming is starting to resume.
Through the chair to Representative Wolf, thank you for the clarification. When the facility is in outbreak status, we don't allow in-person contact visits. So they're not visiting when the facility is in outbreak status, but when it's not in outbreak status, they are allowed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Seiniger?
Mm-hmm. Moving, still on page 9, moving to line 68. There's $180,000 in legal services costs for the impact aid case that the department is working on. You may be familiar with this as the disparity test issue that's come up a couple of times this session. Row 69 is an adjustment to the technical and vocational education program funding. There will be several of these. This is a fairly common amendment we put forward. We initially budget based on an estimate of TVEP funding, and then have to adjust it through the budget process. On row 70, there's a negative $1 million supplemental for the Broadband Assistance Grants Program. So this program is designed and intended to provide assistance grants for accessing broadband in school districts and around the state, and the requirements of the program require that it's used for broadband assistance up to 25 megabits. If the school is able to access broadband faster than that, at a faster speed than that, then they're not eligible for this program. So what happens is those schools move up into higher rate broadband and are able to drop off of this program. And so over time, this need will go down. You'll see also a budget adjustment line in the fiscal year 23 budget to adjust this program down to the projected need level. Row 71 is $175,000 in federal funds that can go towards supporting equipment and utility costs in the Department of Environmental Conservation that are continuing to see higher than anticipated utility costs in their facility. There's a similar supplemental last year. We thought we would be fine going into this year, but they're continuing to see those higher utility costs. So we're working with the department to address this going forward to mitigate the issues and try and resolve the problems. On row 72, there's $250,000 for the Department of Environmental Conservation. This is for an unanticipated legal expenditures. There was a similar supplemental last year, but the case has continued to, it's still ongoing, and so this is over and above the normal cost of legal services that DEC incurs. On row 73, there's $750,000. There's a similar request for the assumption of 404 primacy in the governor's fiscal year 23 budget. The department is seeking authority early to begin the startup costs for this program.
Representative Ed.
So, Mr. Steininger, this line item presumes the $4.9 million in the governor's FY23 budget will pass. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes, these will go hand in hand.
PFD is $260 million in UGF, which is a pretty sizable amount of money for a supplemental sort of a mid-year adjustment bill. Am I reading that wrong? I mean, I normally don't see items like this in a supplemental budget, but has that been the practice of the administration to do things like that?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I spoke to this a little earlier to Representative Josephson's question. There's kind of the two different categories of supplemental items. You have the items like what we talked about in Department of Corrections, the unanticipated needs and expenditures, which are your kind of normal supplemental items. But occasionally there is a policy objective or a new program that the administration is looking to start where we seek an appropriation from the legislature through the supplemental bill process in order to begin starting up a new program earlier. And that's what you're seeing here, because this is more of a policy discussion, policy decision that we're seeking to seek the 404 primacy, and the Department of Environmental Conservation is seeking to begin that process in fiscal year 22 to get a head start on establishing that new program.
Follow up.
Well, I appreciate that explanation. I think that's pretty clear. But I guess my finer point on the question earlier was, is this normal? I mean, I've not been on this committee. Last year was the first year in a few years that I was back on the committee. But in my experience, that's not been a normal process of a supplemental. It's been more, as you say, an unanticipated expenses like fires or floods or unexpected agency costs and things like that. I don't know, what happens if the $4.9 million didn't survive the budget process? Where would that $750,000 go? It would go into the department's budget to use for something else. So I just feel like I have to point that out, that budgeting process in this building, as I've always understood it, is certainly forward-looking, absolutely, but never to bank on something passing that hasn't passed yet and fund it earlier in the process. And I'm not trying to lecture, I'm just trying to lean on my past practices of working with supplementals and to let you know that this raises my eyebrows. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edgeman. Any further questions? Continue.
On to row 74 is additional grant funding that the Water Quality Infrastructure Division and Environmental Conservation is receiving, just additional federal revenues. Row 75 through 81 on page 10 are adjustments to the PERS, SB 55 PERS fiscal note from last year. A piece of that fiscal note was reviewing federal revenues in each department and determining whether or not that change in billing of the PERS rate could be negotiated with the federal partners in fiscal year 22. There were a couple within the Department of Fish and Game that they had not identified as not being able to make the negotiation in this fiscal year during the fiscal note process, and so there's an adjustment to that fiscal note. Moving to page 11, items 82 and 83 are the same and associated with those previous items in Fish and Game. On 84 is for the Pioneer Homes. This is $2 million in receipt authority for private pay residents. So an increase in the ability or the number of residents who are able to pay through private pay without need for subsidy of the homes.
So just my own clarification, to put it another way, private pay individuals are being asked to pay more according to the recent bill passage on that issue, and this just increases the receipt authority for them to actually to receive those funds for their increased costs. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Ortiz. This is the budget for the Pioneer Homes. When that bill passed, they had to make a guess as to the informed guess, an educated guess as to the number of residents that would be private pay versus more subsidized pay, and this is just receipt authority to true that up to actual the actual experience.
Thank you.
On 85 is $800,000 in federal reimbursements for people at the Veterans Home, the Palmer Pioneer Home Veterans Home. 86 and 87 are both requests related to the cyber attack that the Department of Health and Social Services has experienced. that cyber attack by shutting down some of their systems created backlogs in some of their programs, and they've had to hire on, whether it's temporary workers or contractors, to come in and help clear through those backlogs. And so this is the funding necessary to accommodate that activity. On number 88, we have another adjustment, and 89, another adjustments to the TVET program. Row 90 is $791,000 in federal receipts to accommodate facilities maintenance for DMVA. This is additional federal revenues that have come in. Number 91 is for the Geologic Materials Center. So one thing that's happened in the Department of Natural Resources in both the Geologic Materials Center and Parks is that COVID created a drop in revenue collections. So what you see here isn't the entire drop in revenue collections, it's just the amount necessary to ensure that they can maintain operations even under the lower revenue collection. So that's $130,000 in the GMC, and on the next page, a little over $500,000 in the Division of Parks in order to ensure operations continue even under the depressed revenues due to COVID. On row 93, we have $1.4 million for aircraft maintenance in the Department of Public Safety. One thing that we've seen over COVID is that the department is having to utilize their own planes more frequently rather than flying on commercial airlines, and that just increases the cost of maintenance for those aircraft. We were able to accommodate this last year with COVID funds. This year we require a general fund supplemental. On 94, we have additional receipt authority for the Criminal Justice Information System. This is receipts that they receive when they perform background checks for third parties and are paid by those third parties. Number 95 is $290,000 for DNA testing turnaround time reduction, working through the DNA testing backlog. Most of this cost was accommodated through a capital project, but as we worked through the issue, there was another $290,000 to complete the project that couldn't be accommodated under that capital project. On number 96, this is an adjustment to avoid an issue where we are currently charging a greater proportion of the time in treasury management to retirement systems than the actual proportional share of work required by those retirement systems. So this is to ensure that we're not overburdening the retirement systems with costs that really should not be applied to them. There's a similar adjustment in the governor's budget, and this is just to make sure that, you know, we're accounting for the costs where they need to be accounted for in the management of those funds. Number 97, this is a request from the Treasury Division to purchase new investment management resources. There's a similar increment request in the fiscal year 23 budget. The department is seeking to purchase those investment management resources, those contracts and licenses, before the start of the next fiscal year. And so they've requested this in supplemental bill as well, and it should be taken in consideration with that other request in the operating budget. On number 98 and 99, as well as several other items in the Department of Transportation, there's some fund source adjustments for the use of Federal Highways Administration CRISA funding. So one thing that we've done in the Department of Transportation budget in last year and this year is utilize the federal funding available to offset unrestricted general fund. As we did that, because the funding is very specific to what source of federal revenue is coming in, we have to make sure that the funds are placed in the right place for the allowable costs. So these adjustments net out to zero at the end of the, in total, but it's making sure that the federal CRISA dollars in the budget are placed where they're actually eligible. There's just some misalignment in the budgeting process last year that's being adjusted for here.
So my own clarification on this particular, in this particular area. So if I'm understanding you, the original budget put some CIRSA funding in areas where we found out later that it wasn't, it didn't fall within the parameters that the federal government put forward on CIRSA funds. But, and so then we replaced that with GF, UGF, but we didn't really have added UGF because we made up that somewhere else in the budget?
Yes, Representative Ortiz. So to kind of give maybe a more complete picture here, so this rows 98 and 99, as well as 100 through 104 on the next page, all of those are shifts from the federal funds to general fund because they were placed in areas that we later, after working through the process last year, later found out were ineligible. However, on to page 14, row 108 is replacing unrestricted general funds in marine highway vessel operations with those same federal funds. So that's where you net out that change. So we found another area in the DOT operating budget that is eligible for those federal funds. And so we've shifted the UGF from one to the other, and then the federal funds likewise. So it nets out zero over the entire DOT budget. It's a true up for basically, you know, just money that in the legislative process, in the appropriation process last year, kind of this process of identifying where the federal funds could be was sort of a late in the process item last year. And so this is just to try and correct for some kind of basically misplaced funds. Yeah.
And I can appreciate that and understand why that would be the case, but didn't we already, though, appropriate, or is this new money that we are adding to the marine highway system that wasn't there with that original appropriation of CIRSA funds, a part of that 18-month forward funding thing? So there's even more money on top of that? Is that what you're saying?
Representative Ortiz, not more money. This money was already appropriated. It just was appropriated in the wrong spot, effectively. So there's no new money coming in through these actions or new federal funds. It's simply pointing the expenditure of federal funds into a different place where it will be eligible, because right now it's in a place where it is not eligible.
I get that, and I'm the one that's being dense here. I realize that.
I may be missing the question.
I guess my question is, okay, I remember last year in transportation, DOT transportation subcommittee and all that, there was this plan to begin to use these CIRSA funds to replace UGF funds for operating in the marine highway system. And yes. So that's the plan that went forward in the regular operating budget. Okay, and I remember that clearly because obviously the marine highway system is very important, so I was dialed in on that. But what you say here is that, and what I'm not understanding is that since that budget was passed, there was some misappropriations of CIRSA funds in other areas. Is that am I correct so far? Not misappropriation, but we thought we were okay in funding them in these other areas, but we found out under the parameters that came forward that we weren't okay.
Yes,
am I correct so far?
Yes.
Okay, so then what I think I'm hearing you saying is that now those funds are appropriated. We didn't lose those funds. We're just appropriating them to the marine highway system.
Yes.
So that's not part of the original appropriation that put forward the 18-month forward funding. It's more appropriated money. It's coming from a different area, going into the marine highway system, because we can spend it that way, but it's more than the original amount of the 18-month forward funding amount.
Yes, but then the next step is then we take an equal amount of money out of the marine highway system in unrestricted general fund and pay that back to the highway and aviation maintenance where we were using the Fed dollars.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, that's the step I was missing. Take over, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Please, Representative Josephson.
Through the Chair, Mr. Steininger, I'm just curious, is this something that invariably Treasury would have caught. I'm not saying that we're not duty-bound to be ethical. I'm sure that you signed or someone signed a document that says we'll make these revisions. But I am curious whether this is our self-motivated fix, or did we get a letter or email from someone?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this is a fairly self-motivated fix. As DOT worked with their federal partners, you know, on our plan for using the money, is when they discovered this. So it's self-motivated, but also in partnership with the federal government, but not, you know, the result of an audit finding or anything of that nature.
Mr. Seiniger, thank you.
Okay. I believe we are on page 13, and that would take us to row 105. And this is a $200,000 increase in program receipts for the Northern Region for right-of-way activities. Row 106 is also associated with that adjustment to those federal revenues. Row 107 is $279,000 related to a bargaining unit agreement with Labor Trades and Crafts. 108 is that other side, the Marine Highway side of that federal adjustment. And row 109 is another one of the TVEP adjustments. Moving to page 15. Rows 113 and 114 are capital projects that actually weren't covered in that last capital meeting, so I'll touch on them here. Row 113 is in the Department of Natural Resources. This is an EVOS project for LIDAR collection mapping modernization. 114 is $200,000 in match funds for the National Historic Preservation Fund. That appropriation received $600,000 in federal funds, but the match was left out of the fiscal year 22 budget, and so this provides the matching funds. Originally, there was a thought that DNR might be able to find the matching funds through other sources, but that hasn't come to fruition. On row 115, we're back to operating items in the Fast Track Supplemental Bill. So the first is voter outreach, language assistance, and election security for the Division of Elections in the Office of the Governor. It's $4.3 million of unrestricted general funds. 116 is $20 million in ARPA SLRF funding for health and other response due to COVID in the Department of Health and Social Services. They were appropriated $20 million in the fiscal year 22 budget. This is doubling that amount to ensure they're able to respond to any of these new variants. 117 is the completion of a 50-50 dividend split of the POMV draw. 118 is a deposit for the Disaster Relief Fund of $34 million. This is continued costs related to the 2018 earthquake, as well as some additional money to ensure there's a balance there should there be another disaster.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to line 116, this would be an appropriation of ARPA monies to Health and Human Services. Was this spoken about yesterday when we were talking about ARPA funds and other types of federal funds? Did we speak about this yesterday? Is this part of the already appropriated funds category or the unappropriated funds category that we're talking about here?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, we did speak about this in our slides yesterday. And to an extent, it's actually part of both. This is an unappropriated portion, $20 million, that supplements a portion that already was appropriated. So $20 million was already appropriated out of the SLRF funding to the Department of Health and Social Services for this purpose. This additional $20 million, you know, adds to that to ensure continued health response.
Follow up?
So just to be clear, yesterday's number that was given to us about unappropriated funds, if this action's taking, that's $20 million less dollars of unappropriated funds. Correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. And those unappropriated funds, for the most part, are spoken for in budget requests from the governor.
Thank you. Is that me?
Thank you. I believe that's Representative LeBon.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And for Mr. Steiniger, a question on line item 117 on the payment of the supplemental PFD. Reading the narrative, it's a transfer from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund account. Does this represent an overdraw of the 5% of market value formula? Or do you have insight into what percentage of the draw against the earnings reserve this represents?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, this does not represent a overdraw of the earnings reserve draw. So what the full language in the bill itself actually amends the POMV draw language from the fiscal year 22 budget to direct 50% to the dividend and 50% to government spending. So this isn't an overdraw of that 5%. It's just ensuring that there's clarity in alignment with the governor's 50-50 dividend plan, that the money to pay the dividend comes from the earnings reserve.
Yep, follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Vaughn.
So with the FY22 budget, the percent of market value draw from the earnings reserve was approximately $3 billion. Would that be correct?
That's correct.
So my follow-up is, this additional dollars on top of that $3 billion draw for FY22?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, it is not in addition to that $3 billion. It is $795 million of the $3 billion going to the dividend. The way it's structured in the bill is to reduce the amount from that draw that goes into the general fund and divert that amount into the dividend fund.
So one last follow-up. In that sense, then, we're replacing those dollars with UGF that are from oil revenue, royalty income versus earnings of the permanent fund. Would that be a correct statement?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative LeBon. Representative Ortiz. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just trying to understand the bookkeeping here. Since the POMV draw has already been appropriated in the FY22 budget, maybe it hasn't all been spent, but we passed a budget that used the majority of the POMV draw for budget items, plus, as mentioned, oil revenue, et cetera. So if you're going to basically peel off $795 million of that draw for additional PFD, won't that have to come out of other general fund items that we've funded already, unless there's a surplus in the general fund? And maybe that's what you're alluding to with additional oil revenue. Maybe that's what Representative LeBon was. The additional oil revenue due to the price increase has given us more general fund dollars. Hence, we can use those additional general fund dollars to pay for budget items that were previously paid with POMV. Do I have that right?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that's correct. So the additional oil revenue is able to pay for those general fund expenditures that otherwise were being paid for out of the POMV draw. And this distinguishment is made because the governor's 50-50 dividend plan is seeking to ensure that the earnings reserve is first paying for the dividend and then paying for government.
Representative Wohl.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So instead of all the POMV and oil money going into a big pot and then we pay out our budget, you're taking the POMV, half of it, immediately paying a PFD, although retroactively immediately paying a PFD, and then the remainder pays the budget. So we can say that the true 50%, not just in dollar value, but the actual dollars that came out of it, are paying the supplemental and original PFD to get us up to the 50-50 amount. I guess I think I answered my own question, but thank you.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Steiniger.
So we are to page 16. So page 16 is the operating supplemental language section of the governor's fiscal year 23 budget. So these items are all fairly technical in nature, but what most of these are doing is extending the end date of appropriations made in prior years for COVID response, where the federal guidance allows for those federal COVID response items in the Department of Health and Social Services to be expended over a longer time span than those appropriations are active for. So for example, here on row 119 is a good example of this, where this foster care independence program was appropriated for fiscal years 21 and 22. However, the federal guidance allows it to be spent into fiscal year 23. And so there's a technical item in our budget to extend the last date of that appropriation to allow for those expenditures forward.
Thank you. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Thank you, Mr. Steiniger. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you. So rows 119 through 132 are all kind of fit that same category of extensions of lapse dates for federal COVID relief programs that can be spent into fiscal year 23. On the next page, row 133 is similar to a request in the capital budget. We addressed it the other day. This is the ability to use the sale of vessels and aircraft by the Department of Fish and Game for maintenance of vessels and aircraft. And on 134, we're moving to operating language sections in HB 300. So this first item, 134, is an extension of a lapse date of a multi-year appropriation that the Division of Labor Relations has used for extra costs in labor negotiations that sometimes come up. The appropriation originally was made in fiscal year 15, and they've been spending down over time and are looking to extend the ability, without an additional cost, extend the ability to access those funds. On 135, we have an extension of CRF grants, COVID relief fund grants made by the Department of Health and Social Services. So there were changes in the guidance very late from the federal government that allows for some extension of the way that these funds are obligated by the grantees. So this is just to ensure that those grantees that received money from Health and Social Services are able to expend within the full time horizon allowed by the federal government. On 136, we have judgments, settlements, and claims for $233,000. On the next page, row 137, This is a capital scope change. Again, this is related, similar to some prior supplemental items, to the cyber attack incurred by Health and Social Services. This is allowing them to use some extra money in the Medicaid Management Information System capital project to address those cyber security needs. So that project is in its completion and has about $1.7 million left over. And the department, it has been incurring costs related to the cyber attack. So they're looking to be able to extend that scope to use that money to satisfy these needs. On row 138, we have a reappropriation. I apologize, the number's not on here. It's about $4 million for emergency weather and catastrophic events from completed transportation programs that they'd like to be able to use to address emergent weather events.
Okay, we have questions from Representative Ortiz, and then Lebon, and then Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to line 136, Mr. Steiniger, the $232,000 being appropriated for judgments, settlements, and claims, can you kind of give me a brief review of what some of those settlements were related to, maybe that, and whether it's like one big case or a number of different cases, the topics of the cases, that kind of thing?
Through the chair, there are two cases, and I'm drawing a blank on their names. I meant to bring a sheet with the names, but I can provide you the names of those two cases. It's just two cases right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, that was also my question on line 136, and maybe a follow-up to Representative Ortiz's question is, these related to the API settlements?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, that settlement just was entered into, not sure exactly of the date, but we don't necessarily have the terms of what the monetary portion of that is yet.
So follow up then, I guess I'm just curious, and maybe the rest of the committee is, to have a little bit more detail about those settlements. Specifically, cases and names, et cetera. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. Should, on the settlements, Mr. Steiner, should this be to the Department of Law and not OPA? Is it possible that's an error?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, I think that's just inaccurate. These are special appropriations through the Department of Law.
Any further questions from the committee? Or any closing statements, Mr. Steiniger?
No, just thank you for bringing me before the committee today.
As always, we appreciate seeing you. So that concludes our meeting for today. Our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, February 7th at 1:30. At that meeting, we'll have a presentation about the state debt and PERS and TERS retirement. I've also set an amendment deadline for House Bill 187, State Agency Publications, to be turned into my office by Wednesday, February 9th at noon. And with nothing to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 2:38 p.m. Thank you.